Baseball Hall of Famer Hank Aaron has died. Aaron made Major League Baseball history, breaking Babe Ruth's all-time home run record. He spoke with me in 1990 about his autobiography, I Had a Hammer.
Welcome to our program. I'm your host. My name is Kevin Gavin. My special guest today is the greatest home run hitter of all time, Hall of Famer Hank Aaron. He's written his autobiography along with Lonnie Wheeler, I Had a Hammer, the Hank Aaron story. Welcome, Hank. Good to have you back in Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's nice to be in Pittsburgh.
Hank, if I'm not mistaken, of course, there's been a number of books about you, and was there not a book where they had autobiographical elements several years ago?
Yes, there was a book that was out about me. It was a book that was written by Furman Bishop, the Atlanta Constitution. Right. That book was mainly dealing with my baseball, right. I mean, you know, innings per innings and things like that. But this book is a little bit different. This book is an autobiography of my life story. It right. has to do with the trials and tribulations in which I went through as a young boy, and then consequently in 73, 74, and some of the other things that happened.
Mm-hmm. What could you say now? What did you feel that you needed to say? And is now the right time? Could you have done this maybe shortly after your retirement as an active player, or what?
I probably could have, mm-hmm. but you know, it had taken 2.5 years to do this book, and right after my baseball, after I finished my career in 76, I just didn't want to think about anything at the moment. I was mm-hmm. glad that I had a career that expanded 23 years, and I wanted to give myself some time to think about it and what type of book I really wanted to write. There were several people that came to me and said, are you ready to write a book? And I said, not yet. I wanted to make sure that if I did write a book, that people were going to understand that it was not going to be just strictly a baseball book. So when I decided to write it, which was 2 years ago, about 2.5 years ago, myself along with Lonnie and some other people, of course, Alicia Byrne and my agent, we decided that I was going to write a book and let people know that there were more to Hank Aaron than 715 home runs, 755 home runs, which I ended up with. There were more to my life than just leading the league and runs batted in. There were a lot of things that happened in my life that needed to be told. And so that's why I waited till now to write this book, I Had a Hammer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of the revelations will maybe shock people who just know Hank Aaron through his statistics, through his play on the field? Or maybe better yet, open some eyes?
I think it's going to open some eyes because, you know, people are going to look at, they've been looking at me as saying that Hank Aaron, the home run hitter, they don't know what happened in 73, some of the ordeals that I went through. They don't know what happened as a little boy growing up in Mobile, Alabama, that not being deprived but just didn't have the things in order to make myself a major league player, you know, having to play with top tops, we call them soda water tops, mm-hmm. Having to play with a broomstick, you know, and things like this. And Kevin, I want to make it absolutely clear to all of your viewers and the people that is listening to our show that I'm not here crying the blues by no means. I'm perfectly happy with my life. I think I've been extremely, I wouldn't say lucky, but you have to put luck in there. But I've been somewhat, I've met some wonderful people in my 23 baseball playing years. But this book having to deal with a lot of those things, you know, and another reason is that I think youngsters, young people coming across, young people who's growing up today, look at this book and say, you know, if Mr. Aaron can do it with little of nothing, I ought to be able to do it with a lot more than he had.
Mm-hmm. You said you're happy with the career, but you use a term early on in the book that you can't be content. And it's not so much with your, obviously, your on-field accomplishments, but it's just the overall picture of baseball, of society from, shall we say, the 50s and on?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, you can't be content. No, that's always room for improvement, if you want to say, a room that you can make yourself better. If I had been content at just playing baseball, I wouldn't have gotten no further than the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. I was content to get to the big leagues. And when I got to the big leagues, I was content to be the best player that I possibly could be. And then when I saw other players that was great, greater, had fabulous careers, I worked hard at trying to be as good or better than them. Mm-hmm. And there were times, you know, of course, when I played my 10, 11 years in Milwaukee, when we only had one newspaper, and played the remaining of my career in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, other players which played in larger markets, for example, in New York City, who had, at back in the 50s, they had as many as 9 or 10 newspapers. Believe mm-hmm. it or not, people may say 9 or 10 newspapers, but they did. They had quite a few newspapers in New York City. And the same holds true for Chicago and some of the other big markets. So I, no matter whether I hit 4 home runs on one given day, in a New York paper, it was only small print. Mm-hmm. So I had to do something or think about doing something that was unheard of. And it's not that I set out to break Babe Ruth's record, but I found out that I could do it, and I just went after it.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned later on in the book, and this is when you're talking about the beginnings of your career in Milwaukee, the beginnings of your major league career, and that has to do with, I'm sure people have done it for years. Don't you think you've made more money or gotten more publicity if you had played in New York, Chicago, or eventually on the West Coast or something like that? But you say you were very satisfied with the city that you were in a sense that was. Of the major league cities, that was sort of right for Hank Aaron.
Yes, no question about it. You know, Milwaukee was just right for me. You know, if I had come up through the minor leagues, a year and a half I stayed in the minor leagues, mm-hmm. I was still very green. I was still freshly. I still had Alabama in my heart, you know, really, in small towns. So if they had thrust the big city upon me like New York, a little 18, 19-year-old kid, having been no further than Mobile, I don't know what might have happened to me. I really don't know what might have happened to me. But mm-hmm. I do know that playing in Milwaukee gave me a sense of contentment. I was not in the fast lane, so to speak. You know, it was more of my nature going to Milwaukee mm-hmm. and rather than going to a big city. So I think it worked out very well for me.
It's interesting. You mentioned you were in the minor leagues for just a year and a half, and at that time there was just so many minor league teams. I mean, you had your Triple A affiliations, Double A, A, you know, B, C, and D, and you know, all kind of leagues. And for the number of teams, major league teams, that's quite an accomplishment in itself, getting to the majors that quickly.
That's right, and that's what I was saying. You know, I was extremely lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. Of course, Bobby Thompson. As the story goes, I played a half a year at Eau Claire, mm-hmm. and that's Class C ball in the Northern League. I played a full year at Jacksonville in the South Atlantic League, and then I went to Puerto Rico to go from shortstop. I'm from second base to the outfield. I learned how to play the outfield, mm-hmm. and then when I got to spring training, I was not ticketed to be with the Milwaukee Braves at the time. Let's face it, they was going to send me back to Atlanta to play in Double A ball. That's where I was supposed to be going. Mm-hmm. But Bobby Thompson cracked his ankle, and as fate had it, you know, they had no other choice but to put me out there. Jim Pendleton, who had a good year with the Braves, came to spring training, and he was about 15 to 20 pounds heavy. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have anybody else to put out there but just a little old skinny kid from Jacksonville. You know, I had played in Jacksonville, and they said, mm-hmm. hey, Charlie Graham said, the job is yours. Mm-hmm.
Before we talk about your major league career, let's talk a little bit about your years as a youngster and even how you got into organized ball. I guess the first real team, in a sense, would be the semi-pro team, the
Indianapolis Clowns.
Okay,
it was the Mobile Bears, right.
The Bears. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, I guess you might, do you have any regrets that... You were one of the last real stars of the Negro Leagues to have made it. Even if it had been a few years earlier, that so many great ball players could have had so much more exposure to a great deal of this country.
Well, you're right. You know, a lot of great black athletes were smothered in the Negro League because there was no room for them. You know, there was no place for them to play. In fact, my year, maybe 1 or 2 years may be off, but Jackie Robinson in 47 or 48, I think, mm-hmm. Was the first year that Jackie came with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But a lot of great athletes, you know, even you look at Satchel Paige, for example, who played many, many years in the Negro League and of course later on got to the major league when he was about 45. Mm-hmm. Larry Doby, who played many years with the Newark Giants, who got to the major league when he was a little older, you know. So I came along just at the right time when baseball was beginning to look at some look at a lot of black players. In fact, they were signing a lot of black players. But you know the funny thing, Kevin, I look back at those years and I said, you know, when a black player got signed, you knew exactly who he was. You know, if a Hank Aaron got signed nowadays, you don't know they got so many of them. We don't know who is what. You know.
I want to say something about this book, and you know, there's let's face it, there are a number of sports books, but this is a very well constructed book. I must say that.
Thank you.
It's set up well, and the sort of the scene setters, if you will, for each chapter sort of tell what the country was like, or that portion of the country was like in that particular time that we are, whether it's the early 50s or as your career goes
right.
on. And you know, I think people, they think back, especially maybe the younger fans, and say, oh, when Jackie Robinson signed and started playing, everything was fine then. Mm-hmm. You know, he went through a lot of trials, but that opened up baseball. Mm-hmm. That opened up baseball. Mm-hmm. If I may quote from the book, in 1953, the major leagues were no farther south than St. Louis and Cincinnati. Baltimore was still a year away from the American League, and there wouldn't be a team below the Mason-Dixon line until the Colt 45 set up in Houston in 1962. Big League Baseball didn't actually get to Dixieland, the real South, until the Braves moved to Atlanta in 1966. The fact is, Jackie Robinson did not desegregate professional baseball in all the United States, just the northern ones. That brings me to after Eau Claire. Your next season was to be with Jacksonville. Was that in Sally League?
Yes, South Atlantic League, right.
What, going back to the South, as a black ball player, competing against whites,
mm-hmm.
You knew what you wanted
mm-hmm.
as far as a ball player goes, as far as a man goes, but were you afraid at all? Because of just the...
Please set the tone for
the reaction of the people, a lot of the people in that part of the country.
Yeah. You mean afraid of my ability? Afraid
no,
that
not that you'd fail, but afraid for your person even.
Well, I guess that's, you know, I was young.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't bother me. I didn't care about anything. All I wanted to do was play baseball. If you're saying, was I afraid of my life, afraid that somebody was going to bodily harm me, never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do. I'm older. Mm-hmm. But back then, I guess, you know, being 18, 19 years old, I guess that's one of the reasons why they draft kids 18, 19 years old and put them in service. You know,
mm-hmm.
It didn't bother me at all. I never mm-hmm. thought about it one way or the other. I just wanted to play baseball. Now, we had lots of problems, no question. We had all kinds of threats. Almost every single night, there were having race riots in the stands.
Mm-hmm.
Horace Garner, who was playing right field for us, was three of us, myself, Felix Mantilla, who was from Puerto Rico,
right.
and Horace Garner. Horace Garner was the oldest of all three of us, and Felix and I were both the same age. And he played the outfield, and then many times he'd be playing right field, and he got pebbled by rocks, and they had to stop the ball game and bring him in, you know,
mm-hmm.
because just couldn't stand it. But it was good for Felix and I because we were in the infield. But there were many nights, many days when, you know, name calling was something that became a joke to us. We laughed at it.
Mm-hmm.
And being from the South, I heard names that I had never heard before in my life. Burrhead, nigger, you know, mm-hmm. you name it and we were called the names, you know. But it got so, to be very honest with you, Kevin, it got so that after every ball game, we would go home. Myself and Horace and Felix were sitting in the room. I said, Horace, what did you hear today? And he'd tell me, what did you hear? Felix couldn't speak English very well, but he learned the word nigger very well. But we would joke about it. It got so really that it was amusing and it was funny that you hear and heard all of these name calling by different people, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I think that maybe we don't realize that it wasn't that it just wasn't done. Blacks and whites competing on the same field. There was actually laws against. I mean, you know, we have to explain to a whole new generation of people that there were laws against competition. You even mentioned something about a black person, and white person playing checkers. I mean, you use that as an example. I mean, that seems. You know,
hey, we had the same, almost the same kind of laws they had in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Almost, you know, it was something that you just didn't hear of. You know, blacks and white playing together in baseball, playing baseball together, you know, especially in the South.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Hank Aaron. His autobiography, I Had a Hammer, the Hank Aaron story. Hank, how important was your Jacksonville manager? You weren't with him that long. Was it Ben Garrity?
Ben Garrity.
Ben Garrity.
Yeah.
You said that, you know, let's face it, a veteran manager could have, let's face it, and the veteran ballplayers could have a lot of prejudices.
Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah.
And they did. But what was it about him?
I really don't know. You know, Kevin, when we broke camp in Waycross, Georgia, that was, as I said, that were three of us. And I'm sure that Ben Garrity, along with the commissioner, well, it was the National League, well, the South Atlantic League president at that time, and also Sam Wilson, who owned the ball club, mm-hmm. They all three of them sat down and they said, now, we got to have this thing to work. And Ben Garrity, you know, as I said before, I've said this many times, I played for many, many managers in my major league career in the minor leagues. But I would have to say he was the one that was most sympathetic to our cause than anyone that I can think of. After every ball game, he would come in and he loved his beer. You know, he could drink four or five cans of beer every night. And he would come in and sit down with us, you know, no matter whether we were in Montgomery or Jacksonville or wherever we may be. And he'd come and sit down and talk with us and try to make us feel comfortable, you know, as much as he could, because he could hear all of the things that was happening. You know, he knew exactly what was going on, you know. So later on, you know, in my later years, you know, I learned to, even then, I appreciate Ben Garrity. He was not only just a great baseball manager, but he was concerned about people, you know, and he was concerned about us.
Mm-hmm. I just have to remind people something that I wonder how many people realize that you started off as a cross-handed hitter. Mm-hmm. And when did that change?
It changed the first year I started playing pro ball, when I was scouted by the Boston Braves. Scout by the name of Dewey Griggs saw me in Buffalo, New York, hitting cross-handed, and he called me over to the stands. He said, why don't you do this for me? He said, instead of putting your left hand on top of your right hand, he said, take your right hand and put it on top of your left hand and just go up to the plate and see how that feels, you know. So it felt kind of awkward at first, but I never will forget the day. It was kind of dribbling a little bit, raining, drizzling a little bit, and I had already gotten a base hit, and we played a double hit, and I think I went something like 7-for-8 or 8-for-9 or something. So I didn't have any, you know, it didn't bother me, so I just switched over and started hitting.
It didn't take long to convince you.
No. So I said, hey, it feels pretty good, better than this way, you know, because I wouldn't have made it that way, you know, really, in pro ball. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have just tied me up, you know. But the funniest thing, I could have been a switch hitter. All I had to do was go on the left side.
You tell a little anecdote about that, but something convinced you not to be.
Yeah, well, I did. I'd taken some batting practice left-handed and in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I never forget it. And I hit the ball well. And a friend of mine, Wes Covington, who later on was my teammate in Milwaukee, was standing next near the batting cage, and I turned the bat loose and cracked his nose, broke his nose, and I never swung left-handed again. Mm. And I said, that's the end of that.
Mm-hmm. When you weren't expecting the call to the majors so soon to Milwaukee, when you did get it, what sort of determination was there? You had to say that, couldn't let, if you felt that you failed, did you feel like you were let yourself down, or more than just yourself? I mean, did you sense that you were carrying other people's hopes along with you, or was that too much at that young age for you to even consider?
Well, as I said before, I didn't think about it in that term, but looking back, you know, and I use this term, God just wakes in mysterious ways sometimes, you know, and some things happen that we don't know what's happening. And what happened was that, yes, I felt like, just as Jackie Robinson on his shoulders carried a lot of weight, you know, that was a lot of things that I had to do, you know, because playing in Jacksonville, and then later on, of course, being abused and by challenging Babe Ruth, there were a lot of things that I had to, a burden that I had to carry, you know, and little did I know at the time, it didn't bother me at all. You know, I felt like I had a job to do when I went to Jacksonville, and I've always felt like the more people say I can't do something, the more determined I was to do it. You know, I've always had, people always wanted to say this, always had the ability to play baseball. That's number one. I always had the ability to think when I got to the plate. I always had the ability to know. I was very patient. So I put all of those ingredients together, and it means nothing but you got to be successful at it, you know. And I just felt like all I had to do was just do what I had to do, you know, and that was to play baseball. I had time on my side, and I was very patient, and I learned how to deal with it.
I must say I enjoyed some of the reminiscences of some of the ball players that you played with, either in the minor leagues or some who were major league players on other teams when you were breaking in and throughout your years. And the point I'm getting to is, did you feel that things might be different as far as segregation might go once you made it to the majors? Because there's an interesting little story by, I believe it was Don Newcomb, who recalled that he had just come back from Korea and wanted to know why are we staying in the same hotel in St. Louis that we did before I went to the Korean War, and while the white players are staying in a different hotel, a much nicer hotel. And so he finally, with another teammate, and I forget who it was, confronted the hotel manager where the white ball players were staying.
I don't believe Jackie Robinson ever, I might be mistaken, I don't think Jackie ever stayed at the Chase Hotel in St. Louis, simply because of the fact that they wanted us to stay in the room. And they didn't want us to eat in the dining room. To answer your question, yes, we all thought that being in the major leagues, that things would be a lot easier. You know, you would be able to do a lot of things with your teammates. A lot of cities just wasn't up for that. You know, we had problems. When I say problems, not so much of the magnitude that was in the South, but we did have problems with certain places we couldn't go to eat. For example, in Cincinnati, we had problems in one or two places. You know, I would go in a place to sit down and have breakfast or lunch, and rather than waiting on you, the waiter or the waitress come by to take your order, they never would take your order. So you just got the message. You say, hell, I better get out of here because I'm not going to get anything to eat.
Baseball all-time great Hank Aaron speaking with me in 1990 about his autobiography, I Had a Hammer. The Atlanta Braves confirmed Hank Aaron's death Friday. He was 86 years old.